The two great powers of the Middle East, traditional enemies, lie north and south of the Persian Gulf, Iran to the north and Saudi Arabia to the south. The history of intense rivalry between the two might once have guaranteed Saudi Arabia would be drawn into this war. And a report in the Washington Post a fortnight ago claimed the Saudi leader, Mohammed bin Salman, was urging Trump to begin the bombing. But it's more complex and more interesting than that. To discuss Saudi Arabia's position as the bombs rain down on its old enemy, we're joined by Simon Mabon, a specialist in Saudi-Iranian relations from Lancaster University. Professor Mabon is the author of The Struggle for Supremacy in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Iran, published a couple of years ago by Cambridge University Press. Simon joins us now. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Simon, did Saudi Arabia press the United States to attack? The report in the Washington Post is highly confident. It talks of four sources for this story. It's highly detailed. Did it happen in your view?
I think that in 2026, it did not happen. At other points in time, in the recent past, it has happened. And I think given that it's happened in the recent past, there's a bit of credibility to the story that the Washington Post has published. We go back to 2007, and the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia at the time, called on the United States to, and I quote, cut off the head of the snake. So that's a direct strike on Iran called for by the Saudi monarch from the United States in 2007. In 2019, we were also very, very close after the Saudi oil refineries were attacked by the Houthi militias from Yemen, ostensibly with Iranian support. The Saudis were pretty angry and wanted the United States to respond. That didn't happen. But in 2026, the landscape is very, very different. And I can't believe that Mohammed bin Salman would have invested so much time and energy in trying to transform this deeply antagonistic rivalry and then go to Washington and say, please bomb them. That doesn't add up for me.
How is it that this rivalry has been transformed? Was it Gaza that brought these two nations together?
No, I think it's far earlier than that. I think it goes back to 2019 and a Saudi shift in approach with regard to the United States. This sense of a shift in the way that the Saudis were thinking about how they could rely on the US. So if we go back to the Second World War, there was an agreement reached between Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, and the US president at the time for a trade, that the Saudis would guarantee US oil and the Americans would guarantee Saudi security. Now, fast forward to 2019, and you get to a point where the Saudis think, hang on, can we really count on Washington for our security? And I think that really was called into question. And so that contributed to a bit of a shift in Saudi thinking. And at the same time, of course, we've got dramatic changes in the kingdom. We've got an attempt to move away from this reliance on oil, an attempt to try and implement these hugely transformative visions, the Vision 2030 project, the cultivation of neom, the big project called The Line, if you recall. There's lots of things going on. And I think MBS realizes that, well, we can't have that. We can't really reshape our country if we're in the midst of a conflict or indeed a protracted rivalry. And so from 2019 onwards, we start to see the Saudis reaching out to the Iranians reciprocating, and we start to get a softening. We start to get these track two diplomatic initiatives working that bring the two sides closer and closer together. And then in the early months of 2023, we finally see Beijing mediating the final agreement, or facilitating it, depending on your take of the situation, and the two agree to restore diplomatic relations.
Is part of this that the United States needs much less of Saudi's oil?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that's certainly part of it. We've seen the huge increase in US production of oil, fracking, shale gas, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's also to do with longer term question marks, and this is going to be strange to say at the moment when US forces are embroiled in a horrific bombing campaign, but I think there are existential questions about the role of the US in the Middle East. We saw it under Obama. We saw it under Trump. We saw it under Biden. We saw that the Trump second presidential campaign was predicated on an idea of withdrawing the US from these protracted conflicts. And so I think there was this broader existential debate about what does it mean for the US to be engaged in the Middle East. Of course, all of that seems to have been torn up and changed now.
Have you a view of why the United States joined Israel in this campaign to bomb Iran to smithereens?
I do. I don't think there's a traditional sort of realpolitik reason for it. I think there's a personality politics dynamic to it. I think there's an opportunistic thing to it. And I think there's a sense of supporting Israel in the midst of all of this. So if we think about what happened last summer with the 12-day war, the US and Donald Trump declared victory, declared that the Iranian nuclear program had been destroyed. And then towards the sort of the back end of last year, there was rumors starting to abound that Iran was working to rebuild its nuclear facilities and rebuild its nuclear program. So we see the starting of this diplomatic initiative. But the US was very clear that it said that it destroyed it all. There were question marks, of course, but Trump was very clear. And then we start to see increasing rhetoric around this idea of stopping Iran's nuclear program once and for all. But we heard that again last year. So there's a question mark about that argument. There's a question mark about the extent to which Iran is supporting its so-called proxies. And I have question marks over the use of the term proxy, but Hezbollah has been dramatically weakened. Hamas is almost destroyed. The Iraqi militias have been embroiled in their own struggles. The Houthis have been embroiled in their own struggles. So Iran's so-called proxy network is far, far weaker than it once was. And so that argument doesn't hold up that Iran was able to exert all of this nefarious influence on the region at this moment in time. And so then we come to, well, Trump and Netanyahu maybe sensed an opportunity. Netanyahu has had a very strong fixation on Iran's nuclear program dating back 30-odd years. And I think there's maybe a sense that it was opportunistic. Perhaps there's also an argument to say that the Israelis were going to go and that the Americans had to go as well. We don't really know, but that's my take on it, I think. And Trump can now say he's the one that finally took the fight to Iran.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm speaking to Professor Simon Mabon from Lancaster University, an authority on the relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Simon, those two countries do seem to have found common ground in objecting to what Israel's done to the Palestinians. They come together there. Is that now a kind of bond between them?
Yeah, I think there is a sense of the two coming together with regard to solidarity for the Palestinian cause, with regard to opposing what both states describe as a genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. So there is that common ground. But there are other points as well. I think there's a sense that the two were, I guess we're still trying to reckon with where this rivalry is at, where these dynamics are at right now. But they were of the view that the best way for the two states to work together and to thrive was to have them working together for regional security. And that is a dramatic shift in and of itself with regard to how different states in the region envisaged regional security in the Persian Gulf. The Saudis long relied on the US. They were starting to think about an inter-regional form of security cooperation. So we started to see joint military exercises, naval exercises. We started to see a deepening of cultural exchanges. Persian food became incredibly popular in Riyadh, for example. We started to see a shift in the ways in which erstwhile hardline think tanks in Saudi were talking about Iran. They were softening on their approach. So you could see this dramatic change in the ways in which they were speaking about this erstwhile other, this nefarious Iran that was no longer all that nefarious. They were working together. Of course, Gaza solidified that. But now, I mean, who knows?
But Saudi has been hit by Iran since the bombing began on February 28.
Yeah, it has. So the Iranians were very clear at the start, or at least they tried to be very clear, that they were only targeting US bases. So that was their argument. Look, we are not targeting our brothers on the other side of the Gulf. That is not an argument that was bought in Riyadh. It was not bought in Doha, in Abu Dhabi, et cetera, et cetera. The Gulf states, the Arab Gulf states, said this is an attack on our states, our territory. The Iranians rejected that and said, no, we're not attacking you because you are our Muslim brothers.
But all of those Muslim brothers have American bases on their soil. And,
yes.
And in Saudi Arabia, those bases are significant, aren't they? They're big.
Yeah, I mean, they're big across the region. You look at a map of U.S. bases across the Gulf and you see some pretty sizable ones. Al Udeid in Qatar, for example. The Fifth Fleet is based in Bahrain. And so there were pretty serious structural issues, I think, with regard to this broader recalibration of regional security. But I guess the argument was that, look, we're not targeting you. We're targeting the state that is bombing us.
Yeah.
But it was just an argument that did not hold. It did not land well in Riyadh, in Doha, and elsewhere. They said this is an attack on us.
So what was the response of, I love his initials, I don't much love the man, but MBS, the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman?
So he was quite vocal in his condemnation of the Iranians, of the war more broadly. There were calls for de-escalation. But it was also in the sense of, well, we are now being attacked by our erstwhile rival. And they say that they're not attacking us, but they are attacking us. And it should be noted as well, I think, that the Iranian attacks gradually sort of started to spread out beyond US bases. So there were thwarted attacks on the airport in Riyadh, for example, on oil refineries, on other non-US related targets in Saudi, and indeed elsewhere across the region. And I think that undermines the Iranian argument that this is just an attack on US targets.
But what's been the Saudi response to that?
Well, they've been quite cautious, I think, at present. They've been trying to intercept everything, of course. They've thus far refused to get directly drawn into the conflict. Unlike Qatar, which has directly shot down some planes, I believe, although there is a lot of disinformation out there. So just to caveat that, the Saudis have been quite cautious. And from what I understand, there are still talks going on between the Saudis and the Iranian counterparts. There is still a direct line of dialogue, which is reassuring, because in the past, if this had happened, diplomatic relations would have been cut. Diplomatic relations were cut in 2016 when there were protests and the Saudi consulate in Tehran was set on fire. So the fact that there hasn't been a real cessation of diplomatic relations, I think, tells us something, that there is perhaps a glimmer. I mean, it's probably a glimmer that's on life support, but a glimmer of hope that this relationship, this burgeoning relationship, is not dead as yet. But if it carries on much longer, this bombing carries on much longer, there's a good chance that it will be.
Would Saudi Arabia celebrate an Iran that was torn to pieces by this war?
No. No, I really do not believe so. And this goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about stability, about the Saudis realizing that the way that they get to enact their vision, the way that MBS, let's put this very clearly, the way that MBS gets to enact his vision. This isn't a Saudi vision. This is his flagship. The Vision 2030, NEOM, the line, etc. That can only be done with stability. That can only be done with a region that is not beset by conflict. So that's why he was so, or one of the reasons why he was so vocal on what was happening in Gaza. But it's also why I don't think that the Iranians would why the Saudis would celebrate a decimated Iran. They have been very, very anxious about what Iran might look like if it was bombed, and all of the deep schisms within Iranian society were opened up. That would not be helpful for MBS. So no, I really believe that they would not celebrate that.
Because his plan for the post-oil prosperity of Saudi Arabia includes, doesn't it, a lot of tourism. The place has got to be friendly. It's got to be welcoming. It's got to be safe.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of states in the region that are hanging their hat on the tourist hook, if you will. Saudi Arabia and Jordan in particular, we should say. And tourists are not going to go if there is the risk of conflict breaking out, if there's a risk of violence or violent terrorist attacks or anything of the like. And if the situation continues, airlines are not going to fly there. So the Saudis do not want this instability. They want a calm, peaceful neighborhood.
But they don't need the Strait of Hormuz to get their oil out.
No, but they are also bound up within global supply chains. They are also a key part of those global supply chains. And as a consequence, they do not want the instability that is bound up in the closure of the Strait of Hormuz to affect their own oil prices, their own oil supply, and their own position in the global economy.
And where does this leave them in relation to Israel? What is their attitude to Israel? What challenge, if any, do they present to Netanyahu?
I think that's the million-dollar question, or perhaps the billion-dollar question right now. So back in 2023, prior to October 7, the Hamas terrorist attacks on Israel, there was a lot of talk that the Saudis and the Israelis were about ready to normalize relations. And that would have been hugely symbolic, hugely significant, the last sort of bastion of the Muslim world, leaving Iran aside for now, normalizing relations with Israel. I don't think that they were quite ready to do that. I don't think it was quite as far down the track as many would have us believe. But I think right now, in light of everything that's happened in Gaza, in light of what the Saudis consider to be a genocide, the MBS and others have been very, very clear that they will not consider normalizing with Israel without a Palestinian state being set up. And so that's very, very clear to me. And MBS has said, look, I can't do it for fear of being assassinated. And he's obviously alluding to Anwar Sadat, who was killed after signing a diplomatic treaty with Israel. So there's a precedent there, I think. But there's also the sense that, well, the Israelis and their policies with regard to the West Bank, with regard to Gaza, are making it so that a Palestinian state is inviable. And if that's the case, then we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. And I'm not sure that the Saudis can normalize with Israel right now.
If a Palestinian state becomes less and less possible.
Yeah, exactly. And the recent legislation that's been passed that allows for settlement building in certain parts of the West Bank, that calls for new forms of legal documentation to demonstrate property ownership, that allows particular people to buy land in the West Bank if there is no legal claim over that land, and this is a dramatic shift from what had happened in the preceding years, then that all makes the idea of a Palestinian state that includes the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, two non-adjacent parts of territory, it must be said, even more difficult. So, yeah, I think it's really tricky.
But one last complication in all of this. Why has Saudi Arabia signed up to Trump's Board of Peace?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. I mean, perhaps it's the sense that if they're involved, they can have a say. If they're involved, they can try and influence the discussions that are happening there. Perhaps it's to continue to try and exert influence over Trump himself. I mean, the Saudis, the Al Saud, I should say, and Donald Trump and his close family have endured quite a positive relationship over the years. But I don't think that the Saudis want to be left on the outside of all of these discussions. And perhaps it's also an attempt to have a say in the reconstruction of Gaza. I mean, ultimately, we just don't know because we're not privy to the internal sort of thought processes that MBS and his close circle have. But that would be what I would suspect.
They want to be at the table.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good way of putting it.
Simon, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been talking to Professor Simon Maybon, Professor of International Politics at Lancaster University, specialist in Saudi-Iranian relations, and author, a couple of years ago, 2023, of The Struggle for Supremacy in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Iran, published by Cambridge University Press. This is Late Night Live.